comments, questions? Yes.
So much, Rupert. That's so inspiring. So, not to go off on another tangent, but what do you think happens to us when we die?
Well... Well, I'll tell you what I think. I can't say this is the definitive answer, of course. It's just what I think. I think when we die, we continue to be able to dream, but we lose the ability to wake up. So, you see, when we're dreaming, every one of us, every night in our dreams, most of us forget our dreams, but most of us dream 4 or 5 times a night. And some people remember their dreams better than others. But in our dreams, we have another body, a dream body. When I'm dreaming, I'm walking around, I'm talking to people. My physical body is laying asleep in bed. But in my dream, I can move around and I can even fly sometimes. So in the dream, what happens depends on my fears, my experience, my memories, etc. I think when we die, we're in a kind of dream state, at least some of the time. And the kind of dreams we have, the kind of dream state we're in, depends on the kind of person we are, our memories, our hopes, and our experience. Now, what gave me a clue as to how it might go on from just being in a kind of dream is once when I was in a dream, I was in a dangerous situation, I found myself praying. Well, I pray every day. It's part of my normal practice. But when I found I could pray in a dream, then I realized that if there's an opening to the spirit, there can be an opening from the dream as well as from the waking state. And you see, I think that when you look at near-death experiences, or most people have heard about them, and some people in this room have had them, I'm sure. Typically, when people have a near-death experience, they find themselves floating out of their body, looking at it from above, then going through a kind of tunnel into the light and feeling a realm of great love and so on. And then, of course, they come back because it's a near-death experience, not a death experience. And these happen in different cultures. They happen differently in different cultures. In the West, they usually take that form. In India, they take a slightly different form. Hindus often have near-death experiences where they float out of their body, they go through a tunnel, but it ends them up. They end up in a kind of large office-like space with an old man with a white beard sitting behind a desk. It's Yama, the Lord of Death. And Yama says to his assistants, he says, "What's your name?" So they say their name. Then assistants get out ledgers and they look it up. And he looks through these ledgers and then he says, "So are you Vinod Prakash, Vinod K. Prakash?" And he says, "No, I am Vinod L. Prakash." And then he says to the assistants, "You've got the wrong man. Take him back." It's a ghastly bureaucratic blunder. So it takes on different forms. And I think it may well be that suicide bombers who hope they'll go to an oasis filled with almond-eyed dancing girls will serve them dates and so on. Maybe that's exactly what happens to them. And maybe atheists who think it all goes blank will find it all goes blank. So this view, the dream theory, you see, fits the facts as far as I can see, and it means that it's completely... everyone gets what they believe in and expect. And you see, the traditional is closest to the traditional Catholic doctrine of purgatory, where you go into an intermediate realm after death, or a bardo, the Tibetans would call it. And then you can go on beyond that into a realm of more absorption into the bliss of God. But you can't go straight there. Most of us would be sort of dazzled by the light if we went straight there. So there's a period of preparation or fast. Anyway, that's my own view for what it's worth. Yes?
I don't know where I read that. There was a compromise that really Descartes didn't believe exactly what we need, and that he didn't think as he wanted to save his life, because if he would take too much from the church, they would punish him. He would be dead.
So. Yeah.
I did read something about that somewhere, but I forgot, so I cannot give you the exact quotation. Do you know anything about that?
Well, Descartes, people had to be careful at that time what they said. I mean, Galileo had a rough time with the Roman Inquisition. It wasn't that rough. I mean, in the history of science, it's often portrayed as if he was tortured in the dungeons of the Inquisition. Nothing of the kind. He had a rather civilized trial. The Cardinal Bellarmine, who was the prosecutor, said to Galileo, look, there's no problem if you say that the Earth goes round the Sun and this is a model, a better model or a better mathematical model. But you can't say it's the truth because it's just a model. And Galileo said, no, it's the truth. And the cardinal said, it's fine to say it's a model, but Galileo insisted on saying it's the truth, and he was put under house arrest as a result. I mean, it was a pretty mild punishment. He was an old man anyway at the time. But it did make people a bit guarded about what they said. But Descartes was, though, I think a perfectly, at that time, almost all, well, all the founding fathers of modern science were sincere Christians. And I think Descartes was perfectly sincere. I don't think he obviously didn't want to cause more trouble for himself than he need. But when he had this vision of the world as a great mechanical system on November the 10th, 1619, it came to him as a vision. The mechanistic worldview was channeled. And he thought it was channeled by the angel of truth. This isn't what you normally read in the science textbooks, but this is the fact of the matter, as he himself reported. And he was so impressed by this that he felt it, I don't know why, but he felt it had been given to him by the Black Madonna of Loreto in Italy. And he went on a pilgrimage 3 years later to Loreto in Italy to give thanks to the shrine of the Black Madonna. Now, he wouldn't have done that if it was just hypocrisy and stuff. I think he was very sincere in his beliefs. And so were most scientists right up until the 19th century, and many of them still today. Stephen Jay Gould, who was, of course, Jewish, wrote he wrote something about the doctrine of non-overlapping magisteria. He said that religion deals with morality, God, angels, belief, that you shouldn't interfere with it. Science has nothing to say about that, and religion should have nothing to say about scientific matters, and they should keep the two apart. And that was the standard view in the 17th, 18th, and most of the 19th century, even into the 20th century, and even today for many scientists. Many scientists are practicing Christians, Jews, or Muslims. And yet when they're at work, they don't challenge the mechanistic worldview because that would ruin their career. So they go along with it like everybody else. But then as soon as they leave the lab, they revert to being a Christian, Muslim, or Jew. And even materialists, you see, don't really believe it. They can't. Materialism says that the mind is nothing but the activity of the brain, and the brain consciousness can do nothing. In other words, materialism says there's no free will. Now, most materialists, as soon as they leave the lab or the seminar room, know there is, because they have to make decisions, and they're in courts of law, they're responsible for their actions. I mean, the whole of our society is based on the assumption that we do have a certain freedom of choice, otherwise the legal system breaks down. Any defense for any crime, anyone could defend themselves against any crime by saying, my brain made me do it. And it's not a valid legal defense, and rightly so. So then even for materialism, you see, you can't be a consistent materialist, because if you say, I'm a materialist, you say, well, there your brain makes you do it. And they say, well, no, I'm a materialist because I believe in science, reason and logic and evidence and so on. But how can you be persuaded if you have no free will? So So I think that in practice, most people are sort of dualists, even materialists, because they don't take it seriously outside the lab or in their real private lives. I think there's various degrees of hypocrisy. In the modern world, the greatest degree of hypocrisy really is among, I think, many scientists. When they're at work, many of them don't believe this materialist worldview, but they know that it will damage their career if they say so. And so they keep quiet. And I think what will really provoke the next scientific revolution is when scientists feel free to come out of the closet. I mean, because I'm out of the closet myself anyway, I have lots of scientists confide in me. You know, they say, you know, I think there's something like this. I think telepathy really happens, but I can't, you know, I think that there's a greater spirit or mind than ours, but I can't tell my colleagues because they're all so straight. And then another person from the same department will come and say the same thing to me, and then another one. So I think probably the majority of scientists are not committed materialists, but they pretend to be. Just like in the Soviet Union, the majority of people were not committed communists and dialectical materialists, but they pretended to be for the purpose of their career. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, how many people were genuine, true-believing communists? Not many. There were some, but not many. I think science is like that at the moment.
Can you explain how animism might speak to multiple dimensions, multiple realities?
How what?
How animism or
animism.
Quantum mechanics and quantum theory could explain multiple dimensions, multiple realities?
Well, I think in quantum mechanics, there are many dimensions. The mathematics is multidimensional. The mathematicians can just invoke new dimensions, you know, by the dozen. In dynamical field theory, there's hundreds of dimensions. In string theory, there's 10 dimensions. In M theory, there's 11. But we can't imagine these dimensions. So the extra dimensions come cheap in modern physics. But it doesn't necessarily correspond to what people talk about on the basis of visionary experience, for example. The way I'd think of multiple dimensions is, again, in terms of something like the dream world, that each of us has different dreams from each other. Sometimes we can have dreams that overlap. Sometimes when people know each other well, they share elements of their dreams. But the kinds of dreams that we have here on Cortes Island may be very different from the kinds of dreams that Africans have in a village in Nigeria, or that people have in Papua New Guinea or in other parts of the world. And in those dream worlds, sometimes they see gods and monsters and spirits that we've never heard of. And those you could call different dimensions. So I think there may be many, many, many kinds of dream world. But I personally don't use the word dimension, because it's a mathematical term that is usually extrapolated way beyond its normal mathematical usage. So I'd prefer to say something like other dream worlds or something like that, rather than calling them other dimensions. And how, to what degree any of these things correspond with these very mathematical abstract dimensions in physics, I don't know. Probably not very much. I mean, these mathematical abstractions are just that. They're abstractions that have virtually no imaginative content.
You didn't mention at all the concept of agnosticism. You were all atheism or believing. What is your view there? There are people who simply have a philosophical doubt that you don't know whether it's... You mentioned a few times, I think it is like that. I'm not sure, but I think it is.
Yes.
That would be an agnostic point of view.
Yes.
What is your view on that?
I think that in the end, everyone's an agnostic because we can't know for certain about things so beyond our comprehension. And in the Greek Orthodox Church and the Russian Orthodox Church, the mainstream kind of theology is called apophatic theology, which means negative theology, which means that theology can only say what God is not, not what God is, because God's nature is by definition beyond our own minds. And an image that St. Thomas Aquinas often used is that, you know, that we couldn't understand the being of God if we saw it directly, because we'd be dazzled by it, just like we can't look directly at the full sun because it dazzles us. Our sight can't take in that amount of brightness, and our minds couldn't take in that amount of truth or knowledge. So there's always an element of doubt or uncertainty in what we can formulate in human terms. So even official theologies have a strong agnostic element about what is not certain. So I think that there's every shade of agnosticism. I mean, some agnostics are atheists who don't want to upset other people, and it's a kind of euphemism for atheism. Others are deep agnostics who say we can never know with our limited human minds the ultimate nature of reality. I'm an agnostic of that kind. But I think we can have guesses or hypotheses, or we can certainly try. And so I think there's every shade of agnosticism. But I think the only people who have total certainty are fundamentalists of the religious and the scientific type. I mean, some of my scientific colleagues, fundamentalists are people who need total certainty for one reason or another. And religious fundamentalists think that they know the truth and everyone else is wrong, and scientific fundamentalists think they know the truth and everyone else is wrong. I mean, some of the militant atheists are basically scientific fundamentalists, but almost everybody in between is an agnostic of one degree or another. So I think agnosticism is a normal condition. And I would, you know, I don't, because it's normally associated with non-committal view about the nature of God, as if it's something you believe or you don't believe. I think where that goes wrong is by treating belief in God as if it's an intellectual thing you sign up to. I think it's primarily an experience. And I think anyone who's had an experience of a greater presence or being needn't necessarily say, that's God. You may say, I've had this experience, there's something greater than me, I don't know what it is. I think that's true agnosticism, but I think one can inquire further and one can find out a bit more, and I think that some of these theological traditions do actually shed light on the nature of divine being in a way that's quite helpful.
I think one more question.
Yeah, one more question.
Would you like to choose the question, Eric?
So tonight, sort of heard you map out this trajectory of human thought and perspective, going all the way to Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas and Descartes, and then to Richard Dawkins and for the modern day philosophers and atheists,
yes,
theologians. Where do you see that trajectory going? Where do you see us in 100 or 200 or 500 years?
Oh, that's a very good question to end with. Well, I can't tell you. I mean, I wouldn't like to guess about the next 100 or 500 years, but I'd like to, I mean, I could guess about the next 10 or 20, if that's good enough. You see, I think that this movement that I'm talking about, anatheism, this recovering a sense of the divine in the light of all the different religious traditions of the world, rather than just saying we go back to the fundamentals of our own faith, but in the modern world, it has to occur in the context of atheism, because atheism has pointed out all sorts of sillinesses in religion, and it's a purifying fire. And so I think modern religion has to be kind of post-atheist religion, not pre-atheist religion. And so first of all, there's that influence, then there's the influence of science, and then there's the influence of other traditions. And what I think it leaves open is a huge range of new questions. Because, you see, science has given us a view of the universe vastly greater than any humans have ever had before. It wasn't till the 1920s that people realized there were galaxies beyond our own. And now we know there are billions of them. It wasn't till 1966 that the Big Bang Theory became orthodox and it became recognized the universe is 14 billion years old. People before that thought it was millions of years old, maybe hundreds of millions, but not 14 billion. It wasn't until we had microscopes and electron microscopes and mass spectrographs and so on that we learned about the inner microscopic nature of matter. It wasn't until we had the theory of evolution, the fossil records, DNA sequencing and so on that we learned about the whole genealogy and descent of animals and plants. All of these are new data that were not present when any of the world's great religions were formed. And what's happened is those have all been treated as completely secular, that the heavens are simply a lot of inanimate matter moving in accordance with physical laws, according to physics and cosmology. But if we take the view that the sun is conscious, the galaxy is conscious, these other galaxies are conscious, then the question arises, what's the relation of our consciousness to them and their consciousness to each other? Could it be that galaxies interact, the consciousness of different galaxies interacts? And if so, how would that happen? Well, it's not going to happen by sending radio signals, at least not very easily, because, as I've said before, our own galaxy is 100 million light years across. If you send a radio signal from here on, as part of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI, it's a program that's funded by the US government, they're beaming out the prime numbers, the decimal places of pi, and other mathematical formulae on the grounds that other civilizations will recognize and will send messages back. But if it gets to the message gets to the other side of our own galaxy, it'll take 100 million years for them to get the message. And even if they reply by return of post, it'll take 100 million years to get the reply. It's 200 million years. Who's going to remember the question? And so if we're talking about communication between galaxies over billions of light years, then this would be much too slow to have any conscious connection within the universe. God and human consciousness are all about consciousness. And what makes the new worldview, the emerging scientific worldview, different from the mechanistic materialist one is that that excludes consciousness, and a worldview that admits it then has a whole range of new questions. What purpose does our consciousness have in the entire universe? If it's just radio transmission we have to rely on, we can't even communicate effectively even with neighboring stars, let alone other galaxies. But if minds can interact at a distance instantaneously or far faster than the speed of light, then one of the new questions for discussion would be intergalactic telepathy. And now, this isn't on the scientific map right now. It's not on the theological map either. And you see, I think that science has given us a world, vast vision of a world, microscopic and macroscopic, but without meaning. Religion gives us a world full of meaning, but without much relation to this scientific worldview. And the real challenge, and I think the most exciting one in the next 10 or 20 years, is bringing these together, forming an anatheism that occurs in the light of science and cosmology, which will take everyone into territory they've never been before. It's not going to be a matter of turning back the clock to fundamentalisms. It's a matter of going forward to the understanding of the nature of the mind based on psychology, brain studies, but also the great insights that come from the Tibetan traditions of meditation and so on, and Hindu traditions of meditation, where they've gone so deeply into the nature of the mind. My favorite text in the Hindu scriptures is the Kena Upanishad, where it says about the nature of God. It says, not that which the eye can see, but that whereby the eye can see. Know that alone to be Brahma, the Lord, and not what people here adore. It's, in other words, what it's saying is not what we can see, but the ability to see or the ability to hear. That is where we share in the nature of God and the nature of consciousness itself. And if that is distributed throughout the entire universe and throughout all the beings and self-organizing forms within the universe, including galaxies, which may have minds far greater than ours, then how does all this relate to religious traditions about God and all the other intelligences in nature? In the Jewish, Christian, and Islamic tradition, there are innumerable angels, which are spiritual beings or intelligences that pervade the whole of nature. In the Indian tradition, they're called devas. In other traditions, they're called spirits. So it's not just between us and God and just the us on earth and God and the rest of the universe is irrelevant. That's the normal approach that people have. It's something vastly greater and richer. And that exploration has barely begun.